Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour wrote a piece that was the New York Times Sunday Magazine cover story, not this past Sunday, but a week ago, titled How Donald Trump's Candidacy Set Off a Civil War Within the Right-Wing Media. Robert Draper is our guest this hour, and he writes about those who have been supporting Donald Trump and those who have not, and how they are not very fond of each other, and who may have been offered some kind of position in or supporting him, thinking they may get some kind of position in a Trump administration, who is advising Donald Trump among the group of conservative media people who like him. Why is there such a rift here? Oh, it's quite a story, and Robert Draper is here to tell the story. He's an author, a contributing writer to many publications, including the New York Times Magazine, GQ, National Geographic. He worked for Texas Monthly for some time and is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, a chronicle of the Bush administration from 2001 to 2007. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Who did see much of a political future for Donald Trump? He begins the story, and that's where we'll start, with Eric Erickson, who has a radio program and began blogging on redstate.com some years ago, who is anti-Trump, but who went to visit Donald Trump and was invited to Mar-a-Lago. He didn't go, but he was invited there. And when he decided to change his mind, and why others have stayed with Donald Trump and championed him, actually. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Robert, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Oh, what a year, Robert. What a year.
Sure. It's, it's November the 8th cannot come soon enough.
I'm with you. I just want it over at this point, too. It's just unbelievable. Well, let's start at this summer convention where you start in the Times piece, which was fascinating, for conservative activists from across the nation, host Eric Erickson, who was a really big deal in terms of, you know, saying who was going to be good for the Republicans and who wasn't. And then it kind of all blew up in his face as well. But he was having this convention. And who did he invite, and who did he disinvite, and who is he in all of this?
Sure. Briefly, just to set it up for your listeners, Eric Erickson is an election lawyer, a former city councilman in Macon, Georgia, a conservative activist, and since 2003, a blogger. Redstate.com, he helped found and certainly popularized, and became a big kingmaker as a result. Now, you know, he has never lived a day in Washington, D.C., but as a conservative activist, was very much a big figure in the Tea Party movement. After a while, presidential hopefuls from the Republican Party would all kind of come to get his advice and perhaps his endorsement. He began hosting this annual Red State gathering where some of the biggest conservative activists in America would get together and politicians to woo them. That was certainly the case last summer, and he invited pretty much all of the candidates. With some reluctance, invited Donald Trump because they didn't really take Trump's candidacy seriously at that point. This was in August of 2015. And sure enough, after the first debate, when Donald Trump said about Megyn Kelly of Fox News that she had blood coming out of her wherever, he promptly disinvited Trump to the gathering. What resulted was something that Erickson had not anticipated. Trump took to Twitter and bashed away at him. That wasn't too surprising. But then some of his fellow members of the conservative media, such as Laura Ingraham, such as Ann Coulter, began to bash him as well. His, I think, something like 30,000 or so readers unsubscribed from Red State. And within a few days, Eric Erickson had somehow become, as he put it to me, a tool of the establishment, where he had been a thorn in the establishment for so long. And this, you know, is kind of the microcosm for this civil war that's taken place in the Republican Party, and specifically in among these very outsized conservative media personalities. Mm-hmm. So that was the focus of the story.
And it happened so fast for Eric. You write about the fact that, you know, at one moment he was really the... I had unimpeachable credentials, you write, in the conservative movement. By crossing Trump, he was a tool of the establishment, and it happened right away.
It did, and for that matter, you know, the problem in all of this was that it began to be not so much a test of ideology, but in defiance of ideology, because Erickson is one of these guys who's kind of a conservative absolutist, has often applied a litmus test to other conservatives and finding them wanting, and certainly did so in the case of Trump, though that wasn't his foremost objection to Trump. Trump's temperament is just the you know, his basic personality is what bothered Erickson, I think, most of all. But Trump supporters frequently give him a pass when it comes to ideology, see him as someone who satisfies the ineffable urge, as one guy, one conservative said to me, of punching Washington in the mouth. And so within days, as you're mentioning, it's not just that Trump went after him and that other members of the conservative media did, but a lot of other people who are Trump backers, some of them members of the alt-right, some of them began to threaten his life. He had ominous people showing up on his doorstep such that he had to get security. And so, yeah, this is the this is where we are in 2016, particularly on the side of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. You spent quite a bit of time, because she's a large voice in this movement, on Ann Coulter, who really loved Trump's hard line on immigration, helped formulate, you say, his immigration policy position, and called it the greatest political document since the Magna Carta. How influential has she been in rallying others from a more conservative, it's not even mainstream, I don't even know what to call it, more conservative, like Eric Erickson's thoughts about how politicians should be, to Ann Coulter, and what she thinks, you know, that Rump's ravings about immigration are where the party should be. I'm wondering her influence, not only among other conservatives, but also with Donald Trump.
Well, it's hard to tell what her influence is in the conservative movement writ large amongst conservatives who are in the rank and file. I can tell you for sure that she has had a lot of influence on Trump, and specifically on the formulation of his immigration policy. Someone your listeners may be familiar with, Charlie Sykes,
sure,
in the Milwaukee area, had on his talk show in, I believe, April or May of last year, Ann Coulter, when she was on book tour. At the time, the book of hers that was out was called Adios America, and it was very much, you know, an anti-immigration screed. And Sykes told me, and this is mentioned in the story, that as he's interviewing her and listening to her talk, he's thinking, wow, this is really remarkably virulent language, talking about Mexican rapists coming over to America and all of that. Then comes June the 16th, when Trump makes his announcement, and Charlie Sykes is listening to it in real time, saying to himself, I have heard this language before. No coincidence there. Corey Lewandowski, then the campaign manager for Trump, had reached out to Coulter, had gotten copies of her book, and later began to consult with her about the formulation of the immigration policy position that Trump put on his campaign website. So if in no other way, and that's not a small way, she's been very, very influential to Trump. And I should add, by the way, Kathleen, that you know, Trump, when he made his announcement speech, actually had a prepared text. I've read about five different drafts of it that have been supplied to me by former members of the campaign. And as it turned out, he didn't even pull it out and take a look at it. Instead, he went on this, like, 53-minute riff. And what he ended up doing was ad-libbing lines that sounded far more like Ann Coulter's book than anything that his advisors had prepared for him in that text. He was indeed very influenced, and I'm not suggesting that he came to all of this with no opinion about immigration, but clearly he had a mind meld with Coulter, and it continues on the subject of immigration, at least to this day.
Yeah. He invited her to Mar-a-Lago. He gave her a few items from Melania's line of costume jewelry, told her he would waive the fee, which is $100,000, to become a member, and she could use the pool anytime she wanted.
That's right, yeah. Now, the meeting in Mar-a-Lago was one that came a little bit later in the campaign, I believe in the beginning of March of this year. on the heels of Trump having had that debate where he insisted on talking about the ampleness of his manhood and saying, I believe his words were, there's no problem there. Coulter then visited with him in Mar-a-Lago just after that and just before his next debate, which was to be in Coral Gables, Florida, and basically said to him, no one wants to hear about, you know, the size of your endowment. You need to behave in a more presidential fashion. She advised Corey Lewandowski, who was sitting there, the campaign manager, that he needed to, like, surround Trump with teleprompters until Trump learned, you know, how to master these devices. And she said, you know, I'm the only one who's losing money off of you, so you need to listen to me. And it was, I guess, struck by a pang of conscience as a result of her saying that, that Trump then promptly awarded her a membership to Mar-a-Lago, his resort club, waiving, as you say, the $100,000 entrance fee. Mm.
I'm having a hard time understanding why people, and, you know, there aren't huge numbers, but they're influential numbers. The Drudge Report, Rush Limbaugh, who hasn't given him full endorsement, but likes Donald Trump. You've got Breitbart, certainly. You've got Ann Coulter. You've got Sean Hannity, first and foremost, who has a huge audience. But what do all of these people see in Donald Trump? Because he isn't, you know, if you just look at what he said from the very get-go, he's not a very kind guy. He said some incredibly inflammatory things. He's put down so many groups. There are so many things about him that you would think would raise red flags for so many people. So what does he have that they're championing?
Well, he may not be a kind guy, but he's their kind of guy. He's pugilistic in the manner of a talk radio host. He also understands the media better than any presidential candidate that we've seen, really, ever. And what that means, among other things, Kathleen, is he knows how to work the media. Now, right. I know that because of, you know, I've spent a lot of time with Trump, and I know, you know, how he's very good at being flattering, very good at appearing solicitous of your advice. It's hard to tell if he actually really is interested in the advice, but he's interested in your believing that he's interested, and he's interested in taking the measure of you as you dispense the advice, just to see where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. But I think in addition to all that, you know, of course, obviously, Trump is good for ratings, too, and that's been nowhere more apparent than for Sean Hannity, who's enjoyed excellent TV ratings throughout this election cycle, in no small measure due to the fact that it has been, as some people accuse him of, airing essentially a one-hour Trump infomercial, frequently having Trump on, sort of coaching him with his answers. So there's that as well. There's a revenue aspect. But finally, I would add that, you know, for a lot of these guys, these guys are not establishment Washingtonians. You know, they're not George Will. They're not hanging out at Georgetown elite parties, talking policy with Colin Powell or Henry Kissinger, and they never have had influence, really, on Republican policies. This is a different set of circumstances. In Donald Trump, we see a candidate who would be coming in from the outside like them, who has a relationship with them, and who has correspondingly no relationship with Washington insiders and really doesn't care to. So if you're a guy like Sean Hannity or Ann Coulter, you're already having some influence over the tenor of his campaign and even the substance of his campaign. This is an opportunity actually to have influence inside a Republican White House of the kind that they've never experienced before. Mm.
You suggest that neither Donald Trump nor Sean Hannity has been accepted in the upper echelon of Manhattan society, the kind of elite society. Can we analyze this a little bit and say that they really want to get back at that society, that they wanted to be welcomed and they were not?
Well, to be fair, Kathleen, that actually was a quote from Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough of the MSNBC program. That's his psychoanalysis. It's certainly an intriguing one. I'm not sure that I'm qualified to do that for these guys. What's pretty clear is that for someone like Sean Hannity, he's got tons of money. You know, he has great ratings in every election cycle. What he does not have is the kind of power and influence that comes with having access to, direct access to a president in a way that other media figures. Again, I mentioned George Will, and he was, in fact, very close to Ronald Reagan. Guys like Hannity did not experience that with Reagan, with George W. Bush, with George Herbert Walker Bush. But Trump is a different animal and someone with whom they're chummy. So, that sets up an intriguing, you know, for them scenario in which they don't they not only get to come and hang out in the Lincoln bedroom or on the East Lawn, but actually, you know, sit down and talk about how to communicate political strategy and what policy should be.
Chief of Staff Sean Hannity.
Sean Hannity has, in fact, he mentioned to at least one member of Trump's inner circle who told me that yes, that's something that Sean Hannity wants. Now, I asked Hannity point blank about it, and he said that's news to me. But what is clear is that Hannity has already played a role, not just simply as a support system to Trump, but actually at least in one case after the tragic Orlando shooting, he crafted a messaging memo that was then passed on up to Trump that sort of was a more, you know, our thoughts and prayers go out to the victims than the more combative approach that Trump ultimately took. I mean, he's gotten his fingerprints are all over, you know, the Trump campaign. It's not just simply a matter of a guy who is a de facto cheerleader for Trump.
Well, tell me about the time you've spent with him. You've been in Trump Tower. You've sat down. What did you guys talk about? And was he a different kind of person off the camera with you? Is he, you know, gregarious and welcoming? Did you have coffee? What did you talk about?
Yeah, sure. I spent for a different and very lengthy story that I did on Trump and the Trump campaign for a cover for the New York Times Magazine this past spring. I spent a great deal of time with Trump, and since then I've had a few interviews with him, too, including, I guess, most recently about 3 weeks ago. He's a very inviting and gregarious fellow. He's subdued. I think that's the most surprising thing. Mm-hmm. You see this guy who seems so pugnacious, particularly at rallies, and he's nothing of that sort. He can be very, very flattering, as I say. He asks lots of questions, he's... he's not terribly, you know, it's fair to say that he's not terribly self-reflective. He's not terribly interested in policy detail. I mean, that's very fair to say. I spent a lot of time with President George W. Bush, who was accused of being incurious, and I would say that George W. Bush is Stephen Hawking by comparison to Donald Trump. But you know, Trump does have, I mean, his self-confidence, you know, his self-assurance is a pretty remarkable thing to be in proximity to. It's clear that he's smart in a kind of emotional way. He has an emotional intelligence, an ability to read people, an ability to understand what it is that they want, and thus, you know, how to get to them. It's on balance, a fairly pleasant experience to be with Trump. And of course, it's a striking experience on its face, just because he is, you know, a party nominee, and we have on the other side Hillary Clinton, who is notoriously media averse. The notion that I would spend hours and hours and hours with Hillary Clinton is just a preposterous fantasy. The notion that, you know, I 3 weeks ago I contacted Hope Hicks, the communications director for Trump, just needed an answer to one question, and Trump called me back, and he ended up staying on the phone for 30 minutes.
Oh my gosh!
And, a lot of it was talking about his great poll numbers. A lot of it was talking about, you know, how he believed he was really going to do well against Hillary in the upcoming debate. It's not like a whole lot of it was usable material, but the sheer fact of him spending that time on the phone with a member of the media is, again, a notable experience on its face, particularly contrasted to the Democratic nominee.
On the other hand, Donald Trump has thrown the media like the Washington Post out of his rallies.
He has, and that's not nothing. I mean, that's nothing to, you know, that he has done that with Politico, with Washington Post, and with other news organizations is something that you can't take lightly. But even as he ritually bashes, say, the New York Times, for example, he talks to them all the time, until recently when Maureen Dowd came out with her book. I mean, he and Maureen were on the phone all the time. Maggie Haberman, our beat reporter, speaks with him frequently. He's spoken with other members of the Times, and I know that he has done that with other, you know, with members of the Washington Post. Even when he won't let them at their rallies, he'll still talk to them on the phone. So it's a curious, you know, dimension, and some of it is, you know, maybe him being punitive. Some of it is just, you know, the showbiz angle of knowing how much his audiences love to hear that, you know, he's treating us like the scum that we are.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a number of people calling in already. Robert Draper is our guest. He is the author of the piece that appeared in the New York Times Magazine a week ago. You probably saw it because it's the cover with a big microphone on the front. How Donald Trump's candidacy set off a civil war within the right-wing media. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls. We go to them just in a moment for Robert. We'll go to them now for Robert Draper. And let's start with Ronaldo in Eau Claire. Hey, Ronaldo.
Yes, Mr. Draper. My question is, two parts and then a comment. The first part of the question is, what exactly are Trump's positions that are not conservative? And two, what exactly has the conservative movement done since the 2008 election? With the huge midterm victories, I don't particularly see the conservatives have accomplished anything. And I, on the other part, my comment is, I'm not exactly too worried about how he says it, but what he's saying. That's what I tend to focus on in regards to what Donald Trump does.
And you like what he's saying on what, Ronaldo?
Well, this is kind of, despite the bad tape that came out, okay, I don't condemn that or anything like that. But what I'm trying to say is, I think the American people are kind of tired of the spin and the elaborate words and, the speeches and all that, and more get to the heart of the matter. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where more people stand, because in 8 years, it's just been one thing after another, in my opinion. I mean, it's just, is the economy good? Well, yes, you got job growth, but then you got more people drawing food stamps, and, you know, it's just vice versa. So that's all I got to say.
Thanks, Ronaldo. Thank you. Robert?
Yeah, sure. So to sort of go backwards on that, in terms of what conservatives have accomplished, I'm not sure if by that what you mean is, you know, what has the Republican Party itself accomplished? And, of course, that goes to a greater question of what has anyone accomplished in Washington in, you know, an era of intense gridlock. There's been a lot of finger pointing as to, you know, who or what begat Donald Trump. And, you know, the establishment will often point to the Tea Party, or they'll point to talk radio. The talk radio, in turn, will point to the establishment Republicans, saying, you guys promised so many things, and then you broke every single promise. You said you'd repeal Obamacare, and you didn't do so, et cetera. It depends on who you ask as to who's responsible for the failure of accomplishment. But I don't think you're going to get much of an argument out of people that it has not been a terribly productive succession of years for the conservative movement. As to the first question about what exact positions of Trump's aren't conservative, that not only depends on your definition, but it also is situational, depending on when you're asking that question, because Trump has moved around a bit. You know, at certain times he has been for soaking the rich. You know, on more recently now he's saying he's for big tax cuts. He was pro-choice at a certain point. Now he says he's pro-life. He has said very kind things about Planned Parenthood, which is anathema to a lot of conservatives. A lot of conservatives believe in a more hawkish foreign policy than Donald Trump does. Trump has said that, you know, he does not want the kind of foreign adventures that we've been in the past, though there is some evidence that he was supportive of invading Iraq back in 2002. He's also said that he would beat the hell out of ISIS, which presumably involves some kind of intervention. Taking the oil would involve some intervention as well. So it becomes, frankly, a little bit confusing a proposition to figure out what Trump's fidelity is to particular issues, much less whether or not ultimately he is a conservative. And there has I mean, we see this a lot in public servants, that they undergo a kind of evolution. Trump's is a little more spasmodic than an evolution, because we've actually seen a number of policy changes just while he's been on the campaign trail.
I thought what Rinaldo said was interesting, that he kind of is tired of elaborate words, that Donald Trump gets to the heart of the matter. We were talking about Harry Truman for some reason a few months ago, and the whole train trip that he took, in which he was trained to talk to people, you know, the farmers, the people at all of the train stops, in just regular kind of conversation, to quit the highfalutin talk. And it served him very, very well in becoming elected. There is something I like to hear, really eloquent language. Give me, you know, Abraham Lincoln, second inaugural, any day, and I'll read it out loud and have read it many times aloud. But there is something to be said for this kind of plain-spoken language that some people like to hear.
Well, and for that matter, at the height of his popularity, people lauded that about George W. Bush. And
yes.
Conversely, found disdainful, say, John Kerry, for example, or Al Gore, who seemed, you know, like an egghead. But Bush spoke in simple, declarative sentences, and, you know, people always said, you know where he stands. That, in fact, was one of the lines that Bush himself would use about himself on the campaign trail in 2004. And it is clear that Trump not only says what other people wouldn't dare to say, but he says what he says in very plain, unambiguous English. Now, having said that, when he says, you know, Obamacare is a disaster, we're going to replace it with something beautiful, I do think that you know, the electorate, you know, has every right to expect more details.
What might that be? Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And for that matter, you know, I've got a plan for destroying ISIS, but I'm not going to tell anybody what it is because I want to be unpredictable. Okay. But I mean, I think it's worth, you know, in the electorate's attempt to evaluate this candidate, at least giving some broad outlines, and no one's asking for him, you know, to like hand over the playbook of precisely how he would defeat terrorists once he is in office. So it's his language has been both plain and vague at the same time, and I think that's, you know, that's among the things that have infuriated conservatives, because they want to know, you know, simply anybody can say Obamacare is a disaster. We, the Republican Party, have been saying that for year after year after year, but you probably should lay out some specifics as to what the remedy would be.
Thanks, Rinaldo, for the call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, thanks. I grew up around Republicans. Republicans were in and out of our household all the time. My parents they were small business people. They had a lot of Republican friends. They came to card parties in our house. Something has clearly changed, because whatever Republicans were, they were not simplistic thinkers. They were strategic thinkers. They were smart people. And I wanted to ask your guest about the influence of Ayn Rand in light of your earlier inquiry about Ann Coulter. There's a certain kind of, I've watched the Ayn Rand tapes, the old Ayn Rand tapes from the Phil Donahue show from the 70s, and there's an infection in the Republican Party of a certain kind of black and white thinking, such that even after the lewd tape and the revelations in the lewd tape, that there are religious fundamentalists who basically are saying that doesn't matter. That's
right.
Just boys will be boys. And the fundamentalism seems to be about economics, about a prosperity gospel, and it's just you and Jesus. And I'd like your guest to tell me that I'm cockeyed wrong, but I'll tell you, something really has changed in the Republican Party.
Interesting points, Rich.
Well, I'm not going to tell you you're cockeyed wrong. I would kind of split that up into some constituent parts, what you said, that is. The Ayn Rand observation is an interesting one, especially so because perhaps no one has more promulgated the texts of Ayn Rand than the current House Speaker, Paul Ryan, who I don't think anyone would consider an intellectual lightweight. But what I have heard people say is that, you know, the obsession with Ayn Rand and the celebration of the individual in the, you know, in the under the shadow of collectivism, is outmoded, and doesn't speak to people anymore. In fact, you know, the caller was just referencing how the conservatives that he used to grew up with were ones who had lots of ideas, and that may well be so, but it's also true that conservatives have seemed to have drifted away from, and I think this helps explain the rise of Trump, away from whole segments of society who feel left out by what they might view as these kind of, you know, discussions amongst pointy-headed intellectuals at the National Review and the Manhattan Institute about pro-growth techniques and more tax cuts for the wealthy. They feel like they've been left out of the Obama recovery, but they've been left out of those discussions as well. And so, now an altogether separate matter is what the caller just mentioned at the tail end, which has to do with social conservatives. And of course, that's a crowning irony of this election, that Hillary Clinton, who had been very much associated with evangelical Christianity when she was younger, was a devout Methodist who taught Sunday school classes, would become such a reviled figure by so many evangelical Christians, and that they would instead embrace the unlikely personage of Donald Trump, who really fits no one's definition of an obvious evangelical leader. We could take this conversation off into an entirely different direction as to why that is. But in any event, you know, it's one of these things for which I think there will be a reckoning after November the 8th if Donald Trump does lose, how it is that evangelical leaders threw in behind him as opposed to one of the other Republican candidates. And for that matter, there will be a reckoning about, how the tail that wagged the dog amongst the Republican electorate this year were these sort of swaths of largely white working class males who fell in so enthusiastically behind Trump, leading behind individuals who were more governance types like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. It's a splintered party for sure. Assuming that the Republicans lose, there's going to be a not so civil discussion amongst those groups.
Yeah, let's talk about the breaking point for Eric Erickson. It was the Megyn Kelly comment some time ago. Of course, most of the breaks from Senate and House leadership came just after the release of the tape from last Friday. What about other talk show hosts in the country? Did it come early on? Was there something that moved people over the edge? Or was it from the very beginning of the Trump candidacy?
Well, so for those talk radio types, most of them really have fallen in with Trump, but there were some, and I mentioned Charlie Sykes, you know, of the Milwaukee area at the outset, who found Trump to be temperamentally unsuitable from the aspect. I mean, from the outset, I think that a lot of those guys viewed Trump as an unserious person, you know, as someone who knew how to get a lot of attention, but who said loudish, boorish things that seemed custom designed to alienate whole swaths of the American electorate Republicans, at least following the loss in 2012, seemed to be of the mind collectively that they needed to reach out to. So there's all that. Now, there are others George Will, the conservative columnist for the Washington Post, who has been offended not just by Trump's temperament, but also been offended by his refusal to learn even the rudiments of foreign or domestic policy. I had reported around the time of the convention that back in the spring, after Trump had pretty much cleared the field, he was wooing John Kasich to be a potential running mate for him. And Donald Trump Jr. spoke with Kasich's top advisors and said, look, you know, your guy could be the most powerful vice president in history. He could be in charge of foreign and domestic policy, which, of course, led the Kasich people to ask, well, then what exactly would President Trump be in charge of? And Donald Jr.'s reply was making America great again. And it's precisely that. You know, George Will was very a great admirer of Ronald Reagan, who was not known as a deep thinker, not known as someone who was interested in policy and minutiae, but who understood, not just, you know, how to build a hotel, but understood, you know, the intricacies of the marketplace, and understood how to deal with foreign leaders. And it's the seeming refusal on the part of Donald Trump to do any kind of study, any kind of preparation, that alienated guys like George Will early on.
Rich, thanks for the call. Victor in West Dallas, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have a question for you guys. Among your little rap sessions you had with him, did Mr. Trump give you a layout of how he's going to work with the Congress of Senate and the House of Representatives? Because they sure seem to stonewall a lot of problems.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'll just give you the answer very succinctly. No, because his belief is that if necessary, he will go it alone. And of course, there is a separation of powers doctrine to which that notion of his would fly in the face. But Trump has largely believed that through the power of persuasion, he'll be able to bring the legislative body to heel. And if it doesn't happen, then he'll just circumnavigate it. We saw, you know, how while he was still struggling to get the necessary number of delegates to secure the nomination, he made a few perfunctory visits to Washington and began talking to Speaker Ryan and to others. But he was never terribly interested in the intricacies of going back and forth. I mean, he liked the idea of negotiating with foreign leaders, but basically Americans, you know, the American government in his view should speak with one voice, and that voice would be the president, and he would be that president. And, you know, obviously we've heard a lot from Republicans who have been understandably upset at Obama's executive orders, have believed his to be an imperial presidency, but I'm here to tell you that Trump's would be, you know, imperial on steroids.
Hmm. I want to ask, it seems as though the parts of his platform that have created the most enthusiasm, I'm going to build this wall with Mexico under the ground, above the ground, you know, in the air, not allowing Muslims to come in this country, or extreme vetting or whatever the position is from month to month, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. When you look at, or when you talk to the people who are supporting him, you know, the people from Drudge Report and Breitbart and Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity, who must enthusiastically embrace all of those policy platforms, he's not going to be able to do any of those things. Do they really think that they're supporting him because we're going to build a wall with Mexico?
Well, let's start with this, Kathleen. I think that where they start from is, you know what, politicians all claim that politics is the art of the possible, and yet nothing seems possible these days. They make a million promises and they break them all.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just blow up the system and bring in a guy like Donald Trump, who has the bravado and the muscle and the coarse language, but also the mandate. We're now, you know, in a little bit of magical thinking here, but imagining that he wins, and then he wins convincingly, the mandate to do what he wants. Will, you know, Mexico end up paying for the wall? No, that's not likely to happen. But you know, Trump really does view everything in life, including this election, by the way, as a negotiation. And you do not play in any negotiation with a weak hand. You at least pretend that you've got a very strong hand. You act as if you do. And this is the opening bid. This is the opening gambit. Mexico, you're paying for it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there will be a bunch of side discussions and all, and ultimately a wall will be built and there will be some concessions for Mexico. I think that that's how everyone who supports Trump figures that it will work. But what they do believe is, you know, overarchingly, is that Trump will get accomplished things that others have never been able to get accomplished, because he has he has just the sheer force of will and self-confidence and experience as a negotiator to effectuate these things. That's the argument.
But they must worry that he's going to go bankrupt.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's, you know, I think it's a very valid concern, you know, given that Trump doesn't even have shareholders that he needs to satisfy. You know, it's him, his family, and his employees. If he doesn't if he walks away from a hotel deal in China, then he goes and does another hotel deal. You know, that's if he walks away from, you know, the Iran deal or something, it's not just Iran who's affected. It's all of our allies in the Middle East. It's our NATO allies, and I think that him being, you know, the Lone Ranger all of his life, has not necessarily given him preparation for the more collaborative view that's required of the leader of the free world.
Robert Draper is our guest this hour. His piece, front page, well, it was the cover story of the New York Times Magazine a week ago on Sunday, how Donald Trump's candidacy set off a civil war within the right-wing media. Our number, thank you, Victor, for your call, 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gail in Fish Creek, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier, your guest was speaking about his the impression of how Donald Trump comes off. Those descriptions would actually, they sound also like an opportunistic predator. And a lot of women who have ended up in an abusive situation find out after they've been with somebody who can give that same persona. Even bosses, even people who hire you, even people you go into business with. And look at all of the people he's taken advantage of. I'm sure they thought he was all those wonderful things and how nice he is and quiet. And then, bam, look at the wake that he's left, the garbage in his wake, all of the lawsuits and the people. Because he has a lot of other flaws where it would be the entire spectrum from ADD, probably why he doesn't want to look at anything, and remember anything and work within a form, because people with that, that's hard for people to do that, to work in structure, when, of course, his narcissism, which he's also, people have said he is, and the sociopath that his ghostwriter has actually labeled him as, he's got a lot going on, and the beauty pageant that he purchased was only so that he could have his own group of women that he could go in, and it was his business. And he modeled that purchase after the guy who had modeled his own elite modeling and was doing the same thing to all these young girls wanting to get into modeling.
Robert.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, a couple things I'd say about that. I mean, for one thing, I was responding to a question of just the impressions that I had of him. And I'm not suggesting that people use this as a kind of benign interpretation of the totality of who he is, but that these are some of the, you know, his characteristics. It also, by the way, would stand to reason that when he's spending a lot of time with a journalist, he's not necessarily going to lay his, you know, let his hair down and, you know, tell me all sorts of untoward things or, you know, view me as his Billy Bush or something. Let's also stipulate that, a lot of politicians fit the descriptor of narcissist. You know, that's they tend to love the sound of their own voice. They tend to crave attention and affection. The question that voters always have to ask is that, okay, these people are not normal people. For them to muster the vanity to think that they could lead the free world suggests that there's something exceptional about their ego. But can that be used for the good? In spite of their ego, or even because of their ego, can they do things for America? Can they drag us across this or that finish line, such that it will all be worth it to deal with the pathos that we may also encounter when we see their emotional underside? That's obviously something that people, you know, have to judge, not only with Donald Trump but with Hillary Clinton. You know, that these are outsized personalities, and you know, the final thing I would add to this is that it shouldn't surprise anyone that Donald Trump can be charming, that he can be funny. You don't get to be as successful as he is by being an utter boorish, unpleasant moron. I mean, it's a failure of the imagination for anyone to think that you can inherit some money from your dad and then, you know, grow it into this even much, much bigger empire and do it only by being a jerk and a bully. I mean, you at certain junctures have to know when to, you know, when to be nice to people, when to turn on the charm. That's the case also for conservatives who see, you know, Hillary Clinton as Lucifer incarnate. I mean, for them to imagine that she's gotten where she has in public life just by knifing people in the back is a foolish failure of the imagination. But Having said that, that is not to suggest that simply because they have these attributes that those are the only that's the sum total of who they are. Obviously, there's a lot more complication to that than simply the most flattering characteristics that they show.
Let's bring religion into this for a moment. You've got Eric Erickson calling on Trump to affect, as you write in your piece, a similar posture of Christian humility. 1 Corinthians, very explicit, he says, Trump not just a sinner, but a gleefully unrepentant one. You have other people like Mike Pence, who's using his religion to say, you know, it took a man to give this apology, and a big part of my faith is forgiveness. And then you've got other religious leaders who are saying, you know, we don't like what he said, but that Supreme Court, you know, we need people on the Supreme Court who agree with our points of view. Isn't it bizarre that you have people from touting religion, but all to their own ends, and they're quite different from each other?
Well, that's right, and this isn't the first time that we've heard, you know, conservative Christian leaders rally around someone who has a lot of character defects. Some of these leaders have character defects, even, you know, very pronounced ones. Trump is, you know, a fairly unusual case in that he's about as secular as they get, and, you know, he even made an admission, I believe it was an ad lib, in his nomination speech in Cleveland, that that I've, you know, gotten all the support from the evangelicals, perhaps more than I deserve, and so at least, you know, there's a, like, showing a little bit of ankle of self-awareness there on his part. But I mean, as you alluded just then, for, you know, just because you're an evangelical Christian doesn't mean that you vote entirely and exclusively on a slate of evangelical issues. I mean, even, you know, evangelical Christians care about the economy, they care about immigration, they care about a lot of things. But it's, but, you know, what you do hear over and over and over is that, you know, he beats the alternative to Hillary Clinton, particularly as regards the Supreme Court, because this is something that could affect us for generations. Of course, this requires believing that Donald Trump will follow through on his promise to nominate some people who are on that list of 21 or so to the Supreme Court, when he has been so flexible, let us say, on all of his other positions.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Whenever, you know, we've been raised to think, or at least to try to follow the money, where's the money going? And I think about all these right-wing radio hosts needing to sell sponsor, you know, position ads, revenue, and it's hard for me to think that they aren't just holding on to Trump because of the money. I can't imagine them, you know, not taking a position in favor of him simply to sell, you know, to sell more advertising. How do you make money if you're not stoking the flames of the far right or the far left or Trump supporters?
Well, let's stipulate that, as far as I can tell, no one in talk radio has gone broke by siding with Donald Trump. He's definitely great for ratings. And by the way, we should probably extend that to the mainstream media as well.
To liberal media as well, to MSNBC.
He has sold papers, magazines, and, you know, including our newspapers at the New York Times.
Sure.
CNN, you know, has been accused widely of giving Trump a big chunk of that $1.9 billion worth of free advertising throughout the primaries. What I'm just saying is that while that's factually unassailable, that these guys are making money off of having Trump around and having Trump on their shows, there are other motives as well. And I'm willing to take on their own terms of that, that Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham and the like, that they have been promulgating certain issues for quite some time that happen to be the same ones that Trump is, regarding trade, regarding immigration, and regarding just their baseline hatred of Obama and Hillary Clinton. And then, as I mentioned as well, that they know the guy, and that the guy has, you know, been nice to them over the years, that he's had them over at Mar-a-Lago, that he's played golf with them, all suggests a kind of cozy future for them, should there be a President Donald Trump.
Let's go to Gary, running short on time, everybody, in Stevens Point. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. My question is regarding the Electoral College. Does anyone poll them, and who are they?
Yeah, I mean, electors are people who are picked from, you know, that in different states. There's 270 of them total. No, they are not being, if they're being polled, they're being you know, they're being pulled unintentionally. And, I mean, they are selected to follow the will of constituents in the particular districts, you know, where they're elected. There have been in the past runaway, you know, electors, but they've been few and far between.
So I'm wondering, when you look at the entirety of conservative talk radio in this country, would you say it's just a minuscule number who have broken ranks with a conservative orthodoxy and become anti-Trump, or more than that?
Well, I mean, among what we would call, say, the conservative intelligentsia, the lion's share of them are anti-Trump, or, you know, and some of them have been never Trump. And there are, then, if you want to sort of break this up a bit more, there are all these Republican, you know, elected officials who have, with palpable reluctance in some case, fallen behind Trump because he's the guy at the top of the ticket. They don't want to depress turnout in the ticket because that could hurt them against the whatever Democrat they're against. And also, the conservative base is still very enthusiastically behind Donald Trump. So most Republicans who are elected continue to be with Trump, albeit with, you know, a certain measure of reluctance. You know, then there certainly are others who I guess you could say are, you know, conservative intellectuals who find merit in Trump. But I think that you are more apt to find the most vocal of Trump supporters who have any kind of platform in conservative talk radio than, say, in, you know, the National Review or the mm-hmm. Weekly Standard. Then, as a category unto its own, would be Breitbart and Drudge, which have been relentless cheerleaders for Trump from the very beginning.
Robert, thank you so much. Oh, what the Republicans have ahead of them, and probably the Democrats, too, for that matter. Thanks so much.
Never underestimate the hubristic possibilities of Democrats.
Thank you. Robert Draper, article appeared in the New York Times cover story of the magazine a week and a half ago. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this show and for on-air production as well here in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again mañana.